Welcome to the Voice Over Work podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services. On the podcast today, we take a little deeper look into a book introduced in a previous podcast with a chapter-by-chapter look at The Art of Effective Teaching. Balance different learning needs, communicate with clarity, motivate, engage, and empower. Written by Gunnar Stevenson, narrated by Russell Newton. Introduction. Back when I was just starting out as an assistant professor, I made a pretty significant error on the syllabus for the course I was teaching. I had arranged the course grading in a way that students earned points for each assignment, and at the end of the semester, everyone would receive a letter grade based on how many points they'd earned. Math has never been my strong suit, and I don't pretend to find complicated formulas and equations easy. Making this confession to you as a former engineer requires some courage. The truth is, I should have caught this very simple addition error on my syllabus. Somehow, I had so many assignments and quizzes, students were able to acquire enough points prior to the end of term to earn A's and B's for the course without completing the final examination. Some exceptional students had even been able to stop completing assignments altogether in the final month of the semester. As a result of my calculation error, many students who crossed the threshold of the grade they wanted stopped coming to class, so attendance in my course dwindled. There were fewer and fewer students each class period, and only those students who struggled and still needed points to get an A would come. For the final test, only the worst performers showed up. If I'm trying to be an optimist here, I could argue that due to this error, I could devote more time to the low-performing students, but the reality was, losing out on the brighter students driving much of the in-class participation had a major negative impact. Class sessions really benefited from participation from both high and low-achieving groups of students. It was clear that the misjudgment in grading calculation was mine, and that I had created more assignments for my class but not gone back to the points required to earn a particular letter grade and adjusted those numbers accordingly. I learned a lesson thanks to this experience. Ever since then, I double and... Chapter 1. What makes a good teacher? Take a moment to think back to your days in school. It can be any level of education, elementary school, high school, or higher education. Sift through your memories and think about your favorite teacher. Who was he or she, and what made this person your favorite teacher? Now, think about the worst teacher you ever had in school. Did she hand out detentions like they were candy? Did he talk down to all the students, telling them they were stupid and wouldn't amount to much? What made this teacher so bad? In my own experience, it takes about 15 seconds to remember my favorite teacher. Her name was Mrs. Stiegel, and she taught me in fifth grade. It was her kindness for her students that I'll never forget. She always asked us as a class, "Who loves you?" And the class would respond in unison, "Mrs. Stiegel." Up to this point in my life, I had nice teachers and mean teachers, but I cannot recall, before or since, any teacher ever expressing love for me as a student. The expression of genuine caring and love clearly meant something to me, as, out of all the teachers I've had, she is one I will never forget. Interestingly, I know I'm not the only student she had such a profound effect on. The last time I visited my hometown, I had a chance meeting with the mother of one of my schoolmates. Aaron and I had gone to school together since childhood, and he'd had Mrs. Stiegel for fifth grade, too. I don't recall ever having spoken to Aaron's mother about Mrs. Stiegel and how she'd had such a profound impact on my life. But during our brief conversation, Aaron's mother asked me if I was aware Mrs. Stiegel had died. I had not been aware, and Aaron's mother told me about how, after retiring from teaching, Mrs. Stiegel had become a natural. Chapter 2. What motivates students? When I originally enrolled in college to study mechanical engineering, I entered as a pre-med student. I had great aspirations to become a surgeon and improve the lives of others. However, as I took classes that were prerequisites for upper-level courses, I didn't have the drive or interest to do well in them. I struggled in courses like microbiology, anatomy and physiology, and the math was more than I cared to handle.
I despised the labs for these classes, slept through a majority of the lectures, and completely abandoned my lab partners in anatomy and physiology lab when we began dissecting a cat. That semester was my last semester in pre-med. Not only was I destined never to make it into medical school with the 1.85 GPA I earned that term, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt being a surgeon was not my dream. It had been someone else's. As a young boy, my parents had always stressed the importance of education, and just like most parents, mine wanted me to do better in life than they had. To my parents, that meant going to college and becoming a doctor or lawyer or maybe an engineer. My parents placed a high value on the importance of getting into an American university and the life of success an American degree would bring. The only problem was that I hated the classes and the material so much, I was sabotaging my own success. When I found out that the lab instructor for my microbiology lab's three-month-long case of strep throat was actually caused by a chronic E. coli infection, I was out. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. What followed was a serious reflection of the subjects and areas I enjoyed, and conversations with professors in those areas who could help guide me on my way to potential careers. Many of these careers held my interest, and I considered... Chapter 3, Clear Communication. When my son was about 2 years old, his mother and I put him down to bed and then decided to watch a movie together, as it was still early in the evening. As David was so young, all his television experience revolved around cartoon movies or television shows, things that were appropriate for a child of his age. Well, David, the curious little monster that he was, decided to pay his mom and me a visit in the living room to ask, "What you watching?" Surprised to see him there, during what was a big and bloody battle scene of some action movie, I blurted out, "An adult movie." I followed this quickly with, "Don't ever repeat that." I just informed my 2-year-old I was watching an adult movie with his mother. While he would be unlikely to remember it, I would definitely never forget the mortification involved should he decide to share this newfound knowledge with anyone else, like his grandparents or the nursery school teacher who watched him during the day. While I realized the error of my words the second they had escaped my mouth, sometimes it's not so easy to recognize where your communication with others has gone wrong. What does it mean to teach? In my haste to quickly answer my son's questions and usher him out of the room, I'd responded to a simple question in a way that was unclear and confusing. It should come as no surprise that teachers can, and often do, teach in ways that are confusing to some students. That's why it's so important to understand and acknowledge what teaching means to us as educators. We each have an internal metaphor of how we conceptualize and plan to realize our thoughts and opinions on how we work with students. Do we see ourselves as a quirky and cool, yet adventuresome Miss Frizzle? Chapter 4, How to Explain Content Well. One of the main duties of teachers is to explain things. They need to present new information in a way that students will understand. If you're an educator, explanation just became one of your primary tasks as well. Giving directions, describing subject matter, talking about theories and concepts that guide us are just a few among the many tasks explanation involves. But what does it mean to explain? By definition, to explain is to make known, to make something understandable, or to show a logical progression of a relationship. The goal of an explanation is to describe or communicate in a way that brings about clarity and understanding. However, that can be quite the challenge, as not everyone learns in the same way. Explanation is really the examination of different ways of interpreting or viewing. What do I mean by this? Let's take a look at chocolate chip cookies. I can describe what chocolate chip cookies are. When I tell you they're sweet treats made of sugar, flour, butter, eggs, and spices, mixed with chunks of chocolate and baked in the oven until they reach the desired consistency for chewy or crunchy cookies, you can begin to get an idea of what they might taste or look like. I could get out a sketch pad and draw some cookies on a plate to illustrate to you what chocolate chip cookies look like. You'll know what they are when you see them. my personal favorite, would be to make them for you. So when they've baked up nicely, we can share a delicious snack together, and you will be able to recognize the cookies by their taste. All of the above are explanations of chocolate chip cookies meant to help you identify and understand what makes them unique from the hundreds of other cookies that exist. When thinking about explanation, think about a scientist taking a deep dive into any particular topic. Chapter 5, Active Learning. When my son David was in 10th grade, he went on a field trip to an amusement park with his science class. The purpose of the field trip was that as the students rode the fun adventure rides, they would collect specific measurements to calculate velocity, force, and whatever else was requested from the teacher. However, in David's case, the teacher left all the worksheets back at the school and didn't realize this until they'd already made it to the amusement park, meaning the kids simply got a free play day at Six Flags. Had the day gone off the way it was supposed to, he would have had a day of active learning, which is when students engage in learning through doing. It's a contrast to passive types of knowledge acquisition, such as listening to lectures or watching presentations. Here, we see the focus change from what the teacher is doing to what the student is doing. We are particularly looking for the student to have a high level of engagement in the learning process. This is why the semester I had the syllabus with errors had gone off so poorly, because fewer and fewer students came to class. There was less and less active learning going on. I used to teach many discussion-based courses. Along with lecture-based teaching, these are the two most common teaching styles most educators utilize, but they don't fit every scenario. Discussion would never work in the large lecture section of a Biology 101 course on a large college campus, and lecture is completely out of place in the smaller corporate training atmosphere. As the educator, you have to examine who your audience is, what you're trying to achieve, and why you're educating the group in the first place. This way, you can make the decision as to what method works best and when. It could be that you use a mix of both methods. Do you have a preference of methodologies? Chapter 6, Knowledge Application for Lasting Learning. When I was in college, I took an English class on romantic literature. It was one of the absolute most horrific courses I ever attended, for a number of reasons. One of them was the amount of sheer memorization the professor expected. I was fully capable of reading a text, processing and analyzing it, and drawing conclusions in relation to other texts based on what I'd read. This professor would simply slap text on the exams verbatim and want us to list the author and title of the work. I hadn't prepared for that, because this was a class in my senior year, and I assumed that level of knowledge would be egregiously low. For the final exam in the course, I studied hard, but there was really too much to memorize. Byron, Shelley, Blake, and so much more. As I was finishing going through Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Kubla Khan one more time, it hit me that I really should tell the professor I'd memorized all the poems in literature. A person from Porlock, a term that has come to symbolize interrupted genius after Coleridge claimed to have been interrupted by such a person in the middle of writing Kubla Khan, had interrupted me, and therefore I should just get an A on the exam for the effort and be done. I was not the only student with this idea. The moral of this story? Cramming is a notoriously poor method of teaching and learning. To ensure students retain what they learned beyond the unit, the final exam, and the state exam, is actually a big challenge for teachers. Knowledge is foundational, and we continuously build on it. Learners will always need a strong and solid educational foundation to have a strong, solid, and successful future. Those students with a cracked foundation, even if it's only one topic or area. Chapter 7, Giving Constructive Feedback. In the small European village where I'm from, I was good friends with a boy a few years older than me. His name was Tomasz, and he was a gifted artist. His parents owned a farm, but they saved up their money, and when Tomasz graduated from our local school, his parents sent him to art school in the city. Tomasz came home around the holidays to help around the farm whenever he could, but mostly he talked about his art classes and how much he loved being in the city. He returned to school for the spring term, and I was happy for him. I thought he was on his way to becoming the artist he'd always dreamt of, that his paintings and sculpture would be shown in galleries one day. One night in March of that year, something happened. I'd been out late on a date, and I saw the headlights on the old farm truck Tomasz's father drove bumping down the dirt road between our farms. I heard yelling because the windows on the truck were open. Tomasz was in the truck, shouting that he would never return to school. His father shouted back that he would because of what he and Tomasz's mother had sacrificed to nurture their son's talent. The next morning, I went to visit my friend and find out why he'd returned home so abruptly and why he refused to go back. When I went down the hall to Tomasz's bedroom, I saw his bags open on the floor while he sat at his desk, looking over a painting with a note attached. I called out to my friend in greeting, but when he turned to face me, he ripped the painting in half and stormed past me, stating he had work to get to on the farm. I walked into Tomasz's room and picked up the painting and note from the floor. The note was a harsh critique of my friend's work in red ink. "Tomasz, you've peaked. You call this art? A child coloring could have done better. There's no vision here, none at all. Whatever potential you had." Chapter 8, Coping with Difficult Students. In the past, I attended some of my grandkids' kindergarten classes several days a week. I met other kids on their first day of school and would quietly observe them and the teachers periodically over the course of the fall term and into spring. One of the children I met right off the bat was named Lucas, and I could tell Lucas was different. He didn't seem to socialize much with the other children or know how to play with them. At recess, he played by himself, with the exception of throwing dirt at other children, and he was easily coaxed into fights. There was a small faction of boys in the class who knew how to push specific buttons that would cause Lucas to act out. As the year continued, I noticed other things as I would stop by this classroom. One day I came to class and all the children had come to the carpet for circle time, but Lucas remained at his seat in the back of the room. His seat had also been moved. Most of the children were seated at the big half-moon table in the middle of the room, but Lucas was at a standalone desk that had been pushed up to one of the corners. Lucas's teacher mentioned he needed the extra space his desk provided and that he didn't like being close to others on the carpet. It usually led to hitting and kicking, and it was easiest to let Lucas decide if he wanted to come to the carpet or not. One afternoon, when Lucas came in from recess, he was in trouble because he'd thrown dirt at another child while playing, and the two of them had gotten into an argument. Because one of the children involved had been having ongoing issues with Lucas most of the year, the teacher asked the principal to come get Lucas and speak to him about his behavior. It was beyond apparent that Lucas was somewhere on the autism spectrum, but his parents had not requested any testing or services for him, so the teacher was trying to use the discipline process. Conclusion. Teaching is a skill and profession that requires creative problem-solving, excellent communication skills, working with difficult students who can sometimes create devastating challenges, and not having all the support you need administratively or monetarily to do the things you need to perform your job in the best possible way. On top of that, in the age of COVID, many people who just aren't cut out for it have become impromptu educators, trying to teach their kids a grade level and maintain full-time employment. It's very well possible that we may emerge from the global COVID-19 pandemic to discover the educational landscape has changed dramatically. That has yet to be determined. What we do know is that high-quality educators are needed more than ever. This book presented many of the personal skills needed to become a top-quality educator working with students in a variety of settings. How we approach teaching is just as important as designing a syllabus or a rubric. I hope this book has given you the skills and resources you need to think about when it comes to the kind of educator you want to be. The practices presented here are some that anyone can implement in their classroom, with their family, in a community learning center, or in corporate training settings. You don't have to use them all at once, just as you see fit for your particular needs. The important part for you to realize is that while you may not be a teacher by trade, you are an educator for life. This has been The Art of Effective Teaching. Balance different learning needs, communicate with clarity, motivate, engage, and empower. Written by Gunnar Stevenson, narrated by Russell Newton. Copyright 2020 by Gunnar Stevenson. Production copyright by Gunnar Stevenson.
To learn more about today's author or book, please visit Amazon.com or Audible.com. Show notes and further information can be found at RussellEricNewton.com. With an eclectic collection of insights, knowledge, and trivia from some of the newest audiobooks on the market, this has been the Voice Over Work podcast, brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services.